Hi, y'all. My name is Tom Robinson. I am an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I'm real grateful to be here and sober tonight. What a beautiful place this is. Bill had been telling me for some time about Monteagle, and boy, you sold it short. You really did. I know that wasn't your intention, but it has just been a wonderful thing. There is a couple of things that do concern me. One is that when I left home, my suit pants fit very well. When I left for dinner tonight and went to put on my pants and my coat, I thought somebody had sent the wrong pants up here. They shrunk. But I want to thank the committee, Bill and Milton, of course, especially for inviting Joyce and I up here to share this weekend with you, because it has just been a wonderful, wonderful weekend so far. Very spiritual weekend. And I know some of the faces here, and I've met some new people here, and that's one of the things I love about this program is no matter where I go, I meet new brothers and sisters in this program, and it's a wonderful way for me to spend my time, and for as Joyce and I travel, we love to go to the different meetings wherever we travel, and I have never yet failed to go into a meeting and always have somebody stick out their hand and welcome me. Now, I wasn't always welcomed everywhere that I went. You may find that a little hard to believe. I always seemed to have my invitations to family gatherings got lost in the mail. Neighbors had parties, and for some reason, I was left off the list. I was not somebody that before sobriety, you know, it's funny, Joyce and I refer to it is BS and AS, before sobriety, at least that's what she says it stands for, and AS, after sobriety. It's kind of our two lives. But, you know, before sobriety, I was not someone that you would certainly want to put on your list for any function, and I understand that today. My sobriety date is June the 20th of 1988. I don't expect that to impress you, but my family thinks it's very impressive because a lot of my family saw me in my years before and saw me drink. But one of the things I am grateful for today, too, is that I have three grandchildren and one great-grandchild, and not any of them have ever seen me take a drink of alcohol. And they've not seen me, in my opinion, they have not seen me living in the state of alcoholism, whether it was taking a drink or not. And for that, I am really grateful. Those are some ends that I have not had to make in my life. I can't say that about Joyce or about my son. But you know, my story is what it is. It was a journey, and the journey is not complete. At least I certainly hope it's not, because I have a wonderful life today. You know, the life I've been given is not, you know, I've heard some people say they want to get their life back. But I don't want any part of that life that I used to have. I used to think I did. But the kind of life I want today is the kind of life that you people have taught me. There's a spiritual way of life. And Michelle gave such a good talk last night. He was a great AA talk. And I certainly always learn something from everybody I talk. And I really want to thank Joyce for being so gentle this morning. Of course, she did know that I was talking last. So, you know, I don't get the last word in very often. But when I do, it's usually, yes, dear. You know, we have a lot of fun jesting with each other. That wasn't always the case. Our jabs at each other used to have a lot of barbs in them and a lot of sarcasm and a lot of deep-seated meanings. But today, when people hear us kidding with each other, that's really just us enjoying life, because Joyce is my soulmate. You know, if she doesn't kick me out by June the 4th, then we will celebrate 45 years of continuous marriage. And you know, and I owe every bit of that to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon, and all of you people, and people just like you in both the fellowships. Because without you, you'd have a different speakers this weekend. There's no question about it. But because of you, you have been able to give us some tools for daily living that have enabled us to go on that journey, as it says in Working with Others, that I have been able to find a power greater than myself And I've been able to live by spiritual principles most of the time. Now, I would love to sit here and tell you that I live by spirituals all the time, but then Joyce is sitting here, so she would probably ask for a second opinion on that. But I have a lot of gratitude in my life today. I am grateful for the God of my understanding, and I haven't always been. You know, when I was growing up, I believed in God, and my mother took me to church and to Sunday school, whether I wanted to go or not. And I had some good times, especially in some of the youth programs. But then the God that I had learned growing up was a punishing God. Now, who told me that? Nobody that I know of. But I developed probably one of my very early resentments in my life was my father died when he was 39 and I was 11 years old. And he died in a car automobile accident and was taken away just, you know, very quickly in the middle of the night. And that's when I developed my resentment at God, the first resentment I've ever had. And, you know, I really did not deal not only with that resentment, but I didn't deal with his death until after I got sober. And I didn't realize that. But I was only able to deal with that because of all of you. And y'all taught me those principles of how to deal with that. And for today, I'm at peace with that today. But it caused a lot of, as you'll hear some parts of my story, that it's certainly because of that resentment that I certainly followed down some paths that were kind of rocky in my early life. But today, I have a loving God. I have a God that is conditional love. And for that, I am so grateful, because my God today is bigger than anything that I've ever seen. And my God is somebody today that I am real comfortable with running my life. And that was a big issue for me today, for me in my life. You know, I am very much a type A personality, and it was tough in me to find anyone, anything or anyone that I was willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of. But today I have that loving relationship with God, and I reaffirm that decision that He is my higher power on a daily basis every morning. I'm really grateful for my family, and I haven't always been. Joyce told you this morning some about the rocky parts of our marriage. But when I got to the point that she talked about, when she wasn't the only one that wanted a divorce. And that's how sick I was. You know, I wanted it just as much as she did. And my attitude was, I'm not proud of this attitude, but my attitude at that point was, don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out. Today, Joyce is my soulmate. She's always been my soulmate. I just didn't recognize it. And, you know, this is the woman that I want to spend the rest of my life with today, unconditionally. She is the one that she can, when she comes back in town and comes down the airport from the baggage claim down there, and I still get that little flutter in my heart when I see her coming down that ramp. And I do not only love Joyce today, I am in love with her after all these years. And I am so grateful that we stuck together. But, you know, there was, when I got sober, which I'll talk more about later, you know, well, we were facing divorce, and I knew that it was in my best interest to probably try and behave during that divorce. God had a different plan for me. I have a son who's 41 years old, and I'm really grateful for him. He has his own journey, and I'm certainly not going to tell his story, but he's had some real struggles in his life. He is not one of us. And I'm real grateful for that. Sometimes I wish I could just take him out, get him drunk, and get him into the steps and get him some solutions for his life. You know, he is 41 years old. He's on his fourth marriage, and he's still working on that issue. But today we have a great relationship, and like I could never even dream for that because of you people in the programs of AA and Al-Anon. Those grandchildren, the only thing wrong with my grandchildren is they live other places. You know, we're not near any of our grandchildren, and we really wish that we were, because we get kind of jealous of some of the people that our friends that have all their grandchildren around. But, you know, those, they have never seen, they call me Papa T. They have never seen Papa T take a drink of alcohol, and I'm so grateful for that. And hopefully, by the grace of God, they never will. And I really know that if I keep doing the things that y'all have taught me to do, that won't be an issue. You know, I'm grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life today, but I haven't always been, because I didn't get sober the first time I came to AA. I came to AA the first time in 1983, a little bit later than Joyce did. She reminds me occasionally she got here before I did, and she did. But when I first came to AA, you know, I didn't want any of this. Didn't want what y'all had. I can remember I went to my first meeting, and I looked up on the wall and saw those 12 steps. After about 5 minutes, I said, "Got that." Not quite that simple. But I didn't stay sober the first time I came, because the only reason I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time was I had severe back problems. My wife was on my back, my son was on my back, my employees were on my back, everybody was on my back, and all I wanted was just people off my back. And I really wanted to keep drinking, but I thought I really need to figure out how to quit suffering consequences. That's all I wanted when I first came. And you can imagine I didn't stay. Because it certainly didn't cure my back problems. I am really grateful for the program of Al-Anon. Joyce got into Al-Anon first, as she told you, and I was not a happy camper, and that is a very much of an understatement. As she really kind of smoothed it over this morning, but I wouldn't live it. How dare she do something like that? People would think I'm an alcoholic. How dare them? But anyway, I'm so grateful that she did, because one of the things that happened is that she was taught how to take all 10 fingers off of me and let me suffer the consequences of my actions. And if I had not been allowed to suffer the consequences of my actions, then I wouldn't be standing here today, because I would probably be dead, because the way that I was drinking and the latter stages of my drinking, I was headed for a quick death. But I love the program of Al-Anon. They have really been so wonderful to Joyce and to our family. And she talked about that couples group that God put in our life. And that was just so amazing. I never would have dreamed in 1995 when six couples got together. And we've been told about the details of a couples program by another friend of ours from another part of the area that was a speaker. And so we just thought we would try it and see what happened. And who would have ever guessed that this many years later we're still alive and well in that program. And it has been such a gift for us to be able to go in there and learn to be transparent. You know, if I don't do anything else tonight, I hope that I can be transparent here in this room, because that is one of my goals in life. When I came in here, didn't want you to know anything about me. But today I want to be an open book, and so I really try hard to be transparent. And sometimes some people tell me it makes them a little uncomfortable, is me being transparent. But you know, that's what I need to be for me today, is I need to be transparent. You know, I've got a lot of things to be grateful for today, but the main thing I've got to be grateful for is the relationships that I have built through walking this journey into sobriety with you and people just like you. You know, I grew up in a little small Georgia town where there's about 9,000 people, and I'm told if you count, you have to count a few of them twice to get up to 9,000, called Cedartown, Georgia. Now, one of the things that I heard not long ago about Cedartown is that there was this traveling salesman that was coming through town, and he stopped at this gas station, and this was some years ago, back then, they still pumped gas, and I think probably they still do that there then. And so the guy came out, and he stuck the nozzle in. This guy told him to fill up his car. So he turns around, he turns back around, he's got a pistol in his hand, he sticks the pistol right in the guy's forehead, takes off the cap to a mason jar, hands it to him, and it's moonshine. He says, "Drink this, boy." The guy's petrified. He takes a big drink of that moonshine and chokes. And all of a sudden, then the guy takes the pistol and turns around and hands it to him and says, "Hold it on me now." That's the kind of town that I grew up in. And I had some of that good Georgia moonshine when I was living there. But I am an only child, and my father, as I say, was a professional person, and my mother and father, they had pretty much lived around that area most of their lives. My father wasn't born there, but we had what I thought was a really good life going. I have alcoholism on both sides of my family. My father's brother and sister both died alcoholic deaths, and I watched that. And then on my my mother's side, her father was also an alcoholic. So I got it honestly. I don't know. I don't have never saw any evidence that my father was an alcoholic. He drank, but I never saw him drink to the way that I learned to drink in my years. But you know, who's to say? Because he did die when I was young, and I was only 11. And when I played sports in school, and I had a pretty good life going up until that 11. And my whole life changed that night that my father was killed. I really didn't get in what I would call serious trouble. You know, I don't have any of those stories of jails or prisons or things to tell you. That doesn't mean that I couldn't have easily ended up there. I just didn't. It's not part of my story. But I did start acting out a lot, and through that resentment that I was telling you about. My first drink of alcohol was sometimes between 11 and 15. 15 was when I went off to a military school, and so I really don't know when. It was sometime in that period, and it wasn't something I planned, but some of the guys had their, we rode down by the river had on our bicycles after school, and one of the guys reaches out and pulls a bottle of Thunderbird wine. Now, some of you are probably old enough to know what Thunderbird wine is. Certainly not something you find on the menu at a fine restaurant. But I'd never had any alcohol, and so they were passing around, and they passed it over to me, and I want a drink, and well, of course I'm going to take a drink. Everybody else is. And I took a swallow of that, and that was the most awful tasting stuff I've ever put in my mouth. And I said, any fears, resentments, and anything I had in that split second vanished. I had that aha feeling that we all talk about. For that very split second, everything was just wonderful in my life. It didn't last long. And I didn't drink any more alcohol for quite some time. But I always remembered, and I still remember to this day, that feeling, and I chased that feeling for a long time, of that first drink of alcohol, when for that split second, everything in my life was just right. All the fears, all the resentments, all those were all gone for that split second. And when I was 15, I was causing my mother some real problems. Bless her heart, she's dead now, but she tried very hard and did a great job trying to raise me on her own, and I wasn't very cooperative in it. But I got my first experience with group conscience when I was 15, because there was a family meeting held about me. I was told that I did not get a vote, I did not get a voice, and a group conscience was held, and I was decided I was going to what I found out later was be a very strict military school. At the time, I was not happy about that. I was very unhappy about being uprooted from my life. But it's the best thing that ever happened to me, because I needed that discipline at that time. I needed some male figures in all in my life. And so I spent the balance of high school at Riverside Military Academy. And I would like to sit here and tell you that I excelled in everything and graduated with honors and all, but that wasn't the story. Every time I got a chance, I got in trouble. The one thing I did do, though, is I made excellent grades, because everything, all that we got as far as our time off or any privileges was based on your grades. We had weekly report cards. See, early on, I learned how to get what I wanted and how to get my way, and I was willing to do whatever it took at that point to get what I wanted, whether it be time off or whatever, and so that was something I started learning early on. It carried all the way through a lot of my life. But I graduated from there, and it was all planned out. You know, families sometimes have plans all laid out for people, but you know, good alcoholics, sometimes we don't follow the script. Mike and I were talking about that earlier, about following the scripts. And so I was ready, all set up to go to college and everything, and so I did what any good alcoholic might think they might do. I enlisted in the Army. Now, that didn't make my family too happy, but, you know, bless my mother's heart, she supported me or whatever I wanted. But see, that military life had become familiar. And see, I was already, all during military school, there would be some occasions for me to drink alcohol, but very, very little. But every time I would get a hold of alcohol after that first drink, I would drink as much as I could get my hands on, no matter how bad it tasted or whatever. That's when I started getting into that drinking of drinking for the feeling. You know, it tells us in the doctor's opinion that we're a group of men and women who drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And see, I was starting to learn what that effect was then. I think some of the occasions that I would drink is when some of the older guys would get a hold of some alcohol, then I would drink their alcohol. I certainly wasn't old enough to buy it or had a way to get it. But I would always drink as much as I could get my hands on when I could get it. And so I really don't start count my real drinking career until I went into service. That's kind of like my boot camp for drinking. And I drank for 25 hard years after that. But in the service then, alcohol was very well accepted. I think they made a lot of inroads in the military today. They've got treatments and so forth. But one of the first things I was told in basic training was that don't drink any Coca-Cola because it stays in your system, but you can drink all the beer you want because you'll sweat it out. And then they had nickel beer at the NCO club, and you know, that fit right. You know, you get 20 beers for a dollar. And of course the dollar was certainly worth a lot more than it is today. But that's when my drinking really started. I didn't drink every night, but every time I drank for the effect. And that's when I started my drinking career. I spent 3 years in the service. Assigned here in the States, and I decided that it would be good to travel because in the military they will let you travel. And so I put in paperwork to go to Germany. And so that was declined, but they did say they did have an alternative for me that it was a nice hot climate they were going to let me go to, and it's called Southeast Asia. So in 1965, I shipped out with the 1st Air Cav, and when they shipped out to Southeast Asia, to Vietnam. And I spent my last 13 months over there. And I must tell you, I was petrified. I was petrified every day I was over there. But I found out how to get alcohol while I was over there. But I didn't do any drugs. You know, it's funny how we can have some things that stick with us. I am one of those dinosaurs called a pure alcoholic. I have never yet sampled a drug of any type. I've not used prescriptions other than the way that they're supposed to be used. But especially when people find out I've been over in Southeast Asia, they find that hard to believe. But when I was growing up in that little small town in Georgia, the people who used drugs were from the other side of the tracks. And that was something that was grilled into me by my mother and other people and whatever. And so that stuck with me. Now, I can promise you, if I got into drugs, I would have loved it. I'm sure I would have liked it. But that kept me from getting into drugs. And I'm really grateful for that today because I didn't have that issue to deal with. But everything was plenty over in Southeast Asia. They offered me a lot of different things and a good package to stay in and extend another tour over there. And at least I had a little bit of sand at the end. So I said, I've survived 13 months over here, and I'm not going to try another 13. I'm out of here. Goodbye. So I did that, and I got discharged, went to Fort Dix, and headed back to Hotlanta, as Joyce called it this morning. And my mother lived in Atlanta at that time. She had knew I was coming back, and she had moved from that small town and moved up to Atlanta. And this buddy of mine had gotten out before I had, and he was selling cars, selling Fords, and he called me one day and said, "Hey, I just sold this Mustang to this tall, blue-eyed blonde." She was blonde at that time. He said, "Let me fix you up with a date." And I said, "Hey, that sounds good to me." And so he did the go-between and so forth and set it up. And he said, "Where you want to meet her?" And, of course, you can take about three guesses. It was my choice to be a bar. Now, the story that Joyce told this morning about the drinking is, I want to cover that because there is a method to that madness. You see, I knew when I first time laid eyes on her in that first night, I knew that she had something I wanted and I was willing to go to any length to get it. Sorry. So I only had two beers. And not because that's all I wanted, But see, I knew that's what I was supposed to do. I couldn't, I wanted to have 25. And she had had a particularly hard day, and she had 2.5, if to be exact. You know, we notice those kind of things. And see, I thought right away, this is my kind of woman. But you see, the problem is, I didn't think that all the way through. 2.5. How many of you in here that have the disease that I have ever drank half a beer? Or wanted to drink half a beer? But I knew just this was my kind of woman. She outdrank me that night. She was the one for me. And so that period of time before we got married, I did not let her see my drinking. I would not let her see my drinking because, see, I knew once again, I knew what I had to do to get what I wanted. And I did a lot of that in my life. I would go to any lengths to get what I wanted. But, you know, I would go with her, meet with her, and I would have a couple of drinks, a couple of beers, and then after that I went home and really did some drinking. I certainly couldn't do it before then because she would have picked up. And I think I did a pretty good job of letting her see the real me. Also at this time, I got a job, and I enrolled in school, in college. And I was taking a full load. I was working full-time. I was taking a full load at college, but I can assure you I still found time to drink. And I picked a fraternity, and I picked one that had the biggest drinkers in there. Surprise. And it was a great life. And when we got married, then I didn't have to keep up the front anymore. I could drink like I wanted to drink. Now, when we first got married, I was not drinking every night. I was drinking most nights, but by this time I was definitely drinking to pass out, or I was drinking to feel it. My drinking was starting to really accelerate at that point. You know, during the service, my drinking had really changed from that just periodical drinking, because we did have a lot of free times and booze was cheap, but that's what everybody did. And I can remember when I was overseas, one of the jobs I was given was to procure the alcohol. Why would they pick me? Huh? Wonder why. But I can assure you, we never ran out. If you think in combat zone you can't get alcohol, think again. You can get anything you want if you put your mind to it. So we started our life, and my drinking started changing. And one of the things I'm really grateful for today is that I never did have, there was never any physical abuse. I really did have a temper at that time, and I really did, I did a lot of abuse, but it was all verbal and mental. And I'm not proud of that. And I had a lot of amends to make for that, not only verbal amends, but I had a lot of living amends to make for that. And I still try and make those living amends today, and the living amends I make for that is I don't do that stuff again today. But anyway, as our life started progressing, my alcoholism started progressing also. I was one of those functional drunks. I still worked, I still went to school. But I went four years there to school, but I didn't graduate because my drinking was certainly taking up a period of time, and it was starting to affect a lot of things. But drinking was beginning to become prime in my life, and everything else would have to take a back seat. And you know, those of you who have my disease, you understand how that progression works. And we would sit there all day long, and I would tell you what my priorities were. But that wasn't so. All you had to do was watch me. I heard a speaker say something several years ago that was really profound for me. He said, if you want to know what my priorities are, watch what I did yesterday. And you know, that's so true. I said that to my son one time when he was trying to tell me about all the wonderful things that he was going to do in his life. And I told him, I said, son, I really watch what you do more than I listen to what you just say. And he did not like that. But it's so true in my life today. Don't listen to what I say. Watch what I do. And that's what my priorities are today, because I can assure you at that point in time, my priority was alcohol, and everything else took a back seat to that. We wanted to start a family, and we found that we couldn't have children, and we did. Were able to adopt a son, and got him when he was 9 months and 2 weeks from the time we put the application in that we were able to get him. And I was so happy. you know, I wanted to give him, I gave him my name. He is Junior. And I just wanted a son so bad. And I did what every good alcoholic did the night we brought him home from the hospital. And I'm sure you all know that. I celebrated. And there's only one way that I knew how to celebrate, and that was with alcohol. And with my family all sitting around there, my mother and I can't remember who else was there, I proceeded to get sloppy drunk. And, you know, that's not a way that you're to celebrate the birth and the bringing of a child into this home. But see, that's the only way I knew to celebrate. That was my solution. And you know, I celebrated the good times and the bad times with alcohol. A lot of times in my, over the years for me, the problem, celebratory times has been more dangerous for me than the bad times. And so, anyway, we started our journey and we brought that son into this world. And I'm certainly not going to sit here and bore you with a drunk law, because I know that if you don't know how to get drunk by now and you're in my program, then you haven't done enough research. But we, you know, I started doing some things that was kind of embarrassing. Joyce mentioned about falling off the stool at parties. But, you know, I usually, at least on that one time she's talking about, I picked a time when she was out of town, and I thought, certainly they won't tell her. What a bet. I'm sure that was the first thing, but all I remember is I was at a party and at our next door neighbor's, and of course Joyce was not there, so I could drink as much as I wanted to, and next thing I know I'm laying on the ground and they're picking me up. And of course she did hear about that. But see, I always thought I'll only drink so much, but I never could stop. Once I started drinking, there was no telling how much I was gonna drink. But I knew for one thing sure, I was going to drink all I could, and I was going to drink till I got drunk or passed out. You know, I passed out on the sofa many times at night. That was my thing. And in 1983, when Joyce announced that she was going to Al-Anon, I was furious. I was just absolutely furious. But my drinking to that time had gotten to it was daily drinking. I still wasn't doing any morning drinking, but I was doing daily drinking. I was certainly way out of control in everything with my life and alcohol. And so I did go to my first AA meeting in 1983, went down to a place called, referred to in town as Woodmont. I got in and out of the car 5 times in the parking lot and walked in, and a couple of guys after I'd been there a few minutes looked at me and said, "You must be new." And I said, "How can you tell?" We know how we can tell the deer in the headlights, the newcomer that walks in. It's kind of like one of our clubhouses downtown. One Sunday morning I was there, and it's 2:02, and we had a morning meeting there on Sunday morning, and we heard something on the door going. You know when somebody's knocking on the door at a clubhouse that they're new. There's plenty of signs to see. Well, it was good that I went to that meeting, because I found I lived in Franklin. It took me about 20 minutes to get there, and I could drink on the way home. And that lasted for probably about 6 meetings till Joyce caught on. So anyway, at that point in time, I decided that AA wasn't for me. It didn't work for me. But, you know, she did something that a lot of you Al-Anons do that I was not very happy about, but I'm real happy for today. Is that I would get up at 2:30 in the morning, and I never did know why. And the reason I got up at 2:30 in the morning is because the alcohol was out of my system. And my favorite place, you know, there on the sofa I would come to, and there on the coffee table would be this magazine open, You the Alcoholic. Have you ever tried to mark the corners and make sure that you can leave it exactly like that you had it so they won't know that you read it? That's hard at 2:30 in the morning. But I certainly would not ever want her to know that I read that article. And she did things like, and I didn't even know this, she told me later, marking the bottle, said she diluted it, but I guess I didn't recognize she had diluted the bottles. I knew there was sometimes that I probably thought, well, gosh, I didn't think I drank quite that much last night. That was when she was pouring it down the sink. But, you know, she tried all those things till she went to Al-Anon, but then all of a sudden she lost her script. You see, we had this little script that we did. I would do this, she would do that. I would do this, she would do that. I knew exactly what reaction I was going to get. I would pass out on the sofa, she would wake me up, tell me it's time to go to bed, on and on. You all know the drills. All of a sudden, she lost her script. She quit waking me up. She even smiled at me. Now, that she hadn't done that for a long time. She quit arguing with me. She took all 10 fingers off of me. And that's the best thing that could ever happen to me. But I was not happy. I wanted her to find the script. Because see, what that did to me, ladies and gentlemen, is it made me suffer the consequences of my own actions. I couldn't go around saying, if you had my wife, you would drink too then. And that was my attitude. I could give you thousands of reasons. And I got away with the thing about being back from Vietnam for quite a while. That worked for a while. But then it quit working. She finally caught on with the jig. And the sad thing is, I believed that for a while. For a long time, I could have given you thousands of reasons why I drank. And in 1984, it'd been a bad Christmas of 1983, I decided that I needed to go into treatment, and I did. I spent 30 days in a treatment center, and I came out of that treatment center, and I did a lot of things. I went to a meeting every day. I went to meetings everywhere. But, you know, that's all I did. I didn't change. I got a sponsor because I was told I had to have a sponsor, and I picked one that had 6 months, and I knew good and well it wasn't going to require me to do anything. And that worked out just like I thought it would. And I stayed without a drink, and I don't say sober because, you know, I hate to hear people come in and say, just don't drink and go to meetings. And this is from my experience, that did not work for me. Because after about 6 months, I drank again. And I spent the most horrendous 4 years of my life after that. And I'll be real honest with you, I don't remember a lot of details, so whatever she says, it's probably true. She has a lot more better memory about it because she was there and coherent, and I wasn't. I've spent through those 4 years drinking and going to meetings. And ladies and gentlemen, don't do both. Please just pick one, but don't do both. And that was really miserable stage of my life. I found the morning drinking. I was drinking just about 24/7, but you know, I was still working. I was still functioning. And I still to this day don't know how sometimes that I did that, but I still... You know, by this time I was self-employed because we'd made those geographical cures all over the country, as Joyce talked about when I was in the corporate world. You know, I lost my two last corporate jobs, and for a long time I just would say that I resigned or was for looking at other positions. Of course, y'all knew what that meant, but now, you know, the truth is I lost them. I did not lose them for drinking. I lost them for my alcoholic attitude. And one of the things I will warn any of y'all not to do, they probably won't work out well for you. Don't tell the board of directors that if they will just listen to you, everything will be all right, that you've got all the solutions. That didn't work out for me in my last job very well because they chose Plan B, and I wasn't involved in Plan B. And so I did what every good alcoholic did when we moved to Nashville. I became self-employed in the industry I retired from recently. And I love being self-employed. Have you ever noticed there are a lot of alcoholics who are self-employed? What does that tell us? But anyway, I spent that 4 years that I don't remember a lot about. My son, you know, bless his heart, he was having a tough time with me. My wife was having a tough time with me. We'd gotten way past the point of where we were arguing. We were living separate parts of the house. We weren't even arguing anymore. And that's, you know, that's bad when you don't even argue anymore. And so on one Father's Day of 1988, I walked into the room and my wife and my son were talking. You know, my son could not stand up to me. And he would still get in the car with me when I was drinking, and which he never should have because I drank a lot in the car. I'm just fortunate I didn't kill anybody. But that day, somehow, he got up the nerve to look at me and tell me, he said, "Not only do I not want to be around you today, but I don't want you to be my father." And this is the little boy that we brought home 3 days out of the hospital. And I don't know what happened that day. God was working through him that day because I got to that point that, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I didn't know what it was. But see, for so long, I knew that I had two plans. Every time I would think of not drinking, I always felt like I had options. This time, it'll be different. Y'all notice my Roadrunner tie? I love to wear it because that's Willie Coyote trying to push the rock over. This time, it'll be different. But see, for so many years, this time may be different. Well, for some reason this day, I only had one option, and that was to change something. My wife and I decided that day we were going to get a divorce, and it was a mutual decision. She had come to that point in her life. She wanted out of the trap. I wanted out because I blamed her for all my problems, and it was time to go. But you know, I had this thought. I said, I've got to change something, and I think it will be to my best benefit that if I'm not drinking when I go through a divorce. And that was the only reason I went. And I started going back to AA meetings. And all of a sudden, something started feeling different. Because I got a sponsor, and this time I got a sponsor that I knew would require me to do something. I did a whole lot more than start going to meetings. And still, for a long time, it was strictly to get through a divorce. But, after about, 8 or 9 months, I knew something was different. Even Joyce told me, she said, she noticed things were different with me. And that's because I had begotten what I wish for every newcomer comes in here, and that's sheer desperation. This has got to stop. I didn't know what it was going to be after I stopped, what was next, but this has got to stop. But at that point in time, I was hurting so bad that I don't think I would have jumped off a cliff if my sponsor told me to, but I would have been over at that cliff looking to see what I was supposed to see. And so I started following some simple directions by other people in my life besides Tom, and I started on a journey. And the journey I started on was one that has been given to us by our first 164 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, this time I became willing to do something different. I still didn't know what that was, but I started working through those steps in my life. And the program that was brought to me is threefold. We have three legacies. We have recovery, unity, and service. And I had a sponsor that took me through, as his sponsor had taken him through, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That first step, I didn't have any problem with knowing I was powerless over alcohol. I wouldn't admit it to you for a long time, but I've known it for a long time because I got to that point where for so many years I said, I'll quit when I want to. And then when I got to that point, I tried to quit and I couldn't. I knew the jig was up. Life being unmanageable, wait a minute, that's a different story. I have a family, really actually on the way out the door. Money in the bank, cars in the garage, da-di-da-di-da. That's what I thought manageability was. Y'all taught me this is not about manageability of things. It's about my life. And so I was able to see the things, the insanity in my life and the things that I was doing to come to grips with that. And it was a long time me coming to grips with the unmanageability in my life. And only then was I able to go in and recognize the insane things that I did. We don't get locked up for being insane. We get locked up for doing insane things. That's what we found in that second step. And, of course, then I developed a relationship with God in that second step, a loving God. And only then was I willing to make that decision, turn my will and my life over to the care of anything besides Tom. But then I had a better solution, and it was a God that y'all had taught me of, that loving God. I went on through the rest of that thorough house clean. I'd done a fourth and fifth step in treatment as well as I was able to in, 3 weeks? And so when it came time for fourth step, I told my sponsor, I said, I've already done that, don't need to do another one. He said, I think you probably do. So I went and got a second opinion, same in third, a fourth, a fifth. But anyway, the opinions were all the same. But at that point, I was willing to do whatever y'all told me to do because I didn't want what I had. And so I went through that house clean and did that fifth step. Got the end of my fifth step, my sponsor said, so? So? I thought I had just done this wonderful bearing of my soul. And of course, all during that, he was telling me things about himself. But I was able to find out who Tom was, and I didn't like what I saw. And so then, only then, was I willing to do that six and seven step. Six and seven for me, my experience is different for a lot of people. They were very simple. In the big book, it says that we take that six and seven after we've done the fourth and fifth. And for me, after I'd done that thorough house cleaning, I didn't want any of that stuff. So it was a real easy decision for me to become willing and ask God to remove those. And so I did, and I moved on. The men's were not very easy steps for me. I had one that was certainly put off to last and didn't want to make by a guy that used to work for me. I fired in an alcoholic rage. But, you know, today I do not have any unfinished amends that I'm aware of. And I've been able to clean that wreckage of my past and only clean my side of the street. I've made those amends to my family, certainly to Joyce and Tom Jr. And from then, you know, I believe the rest of the amends are for me a living amends. And that means don't do that stuff again. And today, the good news is I don't want to live that way today. You know, I continue to use that 10th step on a daily basis, especially at night. And, you know, I think the 10th step is one that we can work out of order because we don't need to keep adding to the wreckage of the past. And anybody that I sponsor, I tell them, you know, we can use that 10th step on day one. Let's don't keep adding to that wreckage. 11th step is one that I use on a very frequent basis every day because it tells me what to pray for. And I only pray for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And if you think about that, that is a tough prayer. That is a tough prayer because what I'm saying is that whatever God's will is for me is okay, and that's what I'm asking for. But it is the solution for me today. And, you know, I've had that spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, you know. And I still try, on a daily basis, I try and carry that message anywhere that I can because it's the message that you have given me that is in the solution for my life today. You know, I am blessed with good sponsorship. I've just recently changed sponsors, and that was a very tough thing to do. But, you know, it was the thing that I needed to do, and that had nothing to do with my old sponsor. It had to do about me. You know, sometimes as we go on in this journey, I needed some different direction. You know, I'm very quick when people I sponsor, if it's something that they're having an issue with, it's that I know somebody that's better at than I'm at, I will give them their phone number and point them in that direction in a heartbeat. And I needed some different direction today. And I'm real grateful for that today. And my sponsor today is sitting back there in that row, Phil. And I'm so grateful. We've been friends for many years. He's been my service sponsor for a lot of years. But he's now my recovery sponsor, too. And I'm so, so grateful for him in my life. I sponsor other people, and, you know, for me, that's the way I get out of me, because anytime I'm talking and working with somebody else, I'm not thinking about me. And that's a big part of the problem. I'm, you know, my head is a dangerous place to be. You know, unity is something that I had to learn. You know, when I walked in here, all I knew was to be apart from. I didn't know what it was to be a part of. And so all of y'all surrounding me, especially my sponsor then, was very great about getting the car. God, I thought if I ever heard that again, I would just throw up. Every time I turn around, get in the car, get in the car, get in the car, get in the car. You know, Mike and I both have T-shirts. We should have worn them this weekend. It's got a circle, a triangle that says, shut up and get in the car. But I'm real grateful for that today because I got drugged everywhere, to picnics, roundups, you name it. And you know what? That's where I learned how to be of people and to be with people and to be a part of. That's where y'all showed me how it is to have friends. I didn't have any friends when I came in here. But today I know people all over the state and all over many places in the United States. And they're my friends. You certainly wouldn't have won me as a friend when I walked in here because I didn't know how to be a friend, nor was I interested in being a friend. But that is such an important part. Those traditions were given to us in 1950, and those traditions are ones that I believe that I can work in my daily life, not only with my group and my district and my area. You know, Joyce and I try very hard to practice the principles of the traditions in our everyday living. That's one of the things we have studied in our couples group is how to apply those to dealing with others. You know, those traditions are the why it works, not only for our groups, but it's in our family. I believe that is the big of the why it works for us. You know, in that first tradition, you know, we learn what common welfare is, not just Tom's welfare. That's all I've ever lived on is Tom's welfare. But I'm learning and continue to learn how to worry about our welfare, not just my, what's good for us, not good, just good for me, and good for you when I'm dealing with you, good for us, not just me. And that group conscience, you know, the group conscience when during my drinking years existing of one, me. I rule the roost. If you didn't like it, don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out. But today, that's not what I want. That's the good news, is that's not what I want. Joyce and I have little systems that we use about usually the person that feels the strongest is the one that we try and yield to in a situation. And it really works. It really works because we're seeking God's will and we're not seeking our individual wills. And, you know, that fifth tradition in singleness of purpose is so important because, you know, I know what my singleness of purpose is in my recovery program, but Joyce and I have found out what our singleness purpose is in our marriage, and that's to seek and carry out God's love and carry the message to others. And that's my message, my individual message, and that's the message that we try and carry in our coupleship as well. And you know, that seventh tradition we've learned how to be self-supporting is not about money. It's about your time and your talents and your love. And you know, we practice that seventh tradition where we are both supportive in our family. And I used to think it was about I'm the one who makes the money and that I'm going to make the rules. That's not the way it is. She always has and brings back more than 50% in our coupleship, and I'm so grateful for that. Joyce is an equal partner in our marriage today, and I am very, very happy with that. I want her to be an equal partner in all of our affairs. You know, in that 12th tradition, and practicing that principles in all our affairs, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. It's good to talk, but it's hard to live. And, you know, we try and practice that spiritual principle in our family of humility. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But when we apply the principles to any situation we run into, we very rarely go wrong. And that's the whole key for me in that. And, you know, the legacy of service has been probably one of the greatest gifts to my sobriety other than the steps. Because when I was also being told to get in the car, I was also told to clean ashtrays. You know, I went to my first meeting out of treatment to the Franklin group, and I got there and the coffee was not ready, and boy, I grumbled around, and coffee's not ready, and you know, a guy came over and put his shoulder around me and said, "Let me show you how to solve that problem." God, I got tired of making coffee at that group. But I learned early on in doing service, and I've been so blessed. You know, we were given, in 1955, you know, Dr. Bob and Bill, the old-timers, turned over the fellowship to the service structure. And that has been such a blessing to have that in the 12 concepts and our warranties that we have. That also can be called the why it works. But he's taught us how to serve. But you know, service to me is anything. It's like Bill says, it's anything we do to carry the message of recovery, whether it's cleaning ashtrays, open up, or whatever. But after I, not only doing the coffee and all, I've been blessed and we're privileged to serve at all different levels of my group and gone on to be, you know, in my district serving and at the district level. And I've been blessed to serve at Area 64, the Tennessee Assembly. I served there for 20 years and never held the same job once. But, you know, every one of those jobs that I held, it got me a little bit out of me. And service has been so wonderful for me. Today, I don't hold a position today, but I do. I'm still involved in service. It's time for me to rotate out of holding positions. You know, I'm still on my steering committee, but I'm not in charge of the steering committee. I'm just a part of that steering committee. You know, I'm a responsible member of my home group, which is the Franklin group, Grateful Live group in Franklin, Tennessee. And being responsible members is I show up when those doors are open and so that I can help be a part of. I do my part in setup, I do my part in chairing, and I show up at the business meetings and help my group to grow. You know, I heard something I've heard for a long time, if you don't think your home group is the best group in the world, go find the one that is. And I tried that not too long ago. But you know, also I was told something else that was a lot better advice for me, was that if you don't think your home group's the best one that there is, stay there and don't go screw up somebody else's home group. I had to take my own personal inventory and some issues that were going on in my home group, and you know, it wasn't a pretty sight. It wasn't something but somebody in that group loved me enough to point out some things that I was doing I wasn't even aware of. And, you know, I was part of the problem. And so today, I've stayed there and become part of the solution. And that's what I want today to be as part of the solution. A guy that I used to work for had a sign on his desk, and you walked in and you had no choice but look at it and say, "Are you here with a solution or are you part of the problem?" Today, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to be part of the solution. I don't want to be the problem. Does that mean I'm not always part of the, not sometimes a problem? Yeah, I can definitely be part of the, can be part of the problem. But I want to be part of the solution today. That is my goal. I'd love to sit here and tell you tonight that I got sober and life has been great and there have been no pitfalls or any bumps in the road, but you know, that wouldn't really be true. I was given so much grace until I got sober as far as physical health and death in the family, except for my father and things like that. And I really believe that God gave me that grace period till I was able to handle some of the things that have come in my life in sobriety. But I also have to tell you, there's nothing in my life today that a drink won't make worse. And I've never forgotten that ever since I've been sober, and I'm so grateful for that. You know, about 9 months after I got sober, Joyce and I realized that things were going to be, were getting better. They were a little different, and we started speaking to each other and going places a couple of times together, and that was really great because God was starting to bring that aspect in our life, and I'm glad He did, because it wasn't long after that till, and I have Joyce's permission to share these things. She was diagnosed with breast cancer, and you know, I can't even think about what would have been like if I had not been sober. But you know, that brought us together. I was able to be there for her for the first time in a lot of years. Because see, the first 21 years of those years of marriage, I was drunk. And I was so happy when I finally hit 21 years sober, because I kind of got even with the years as far as that. But I was able to be there with her and love her all the way through that, the chemo and everything, and it was not pretty. But by the grace of God, you know, she finally got a clean bill of health. And you know, we thought everything was great and everything was being lot free. Next thing I knew, in 1990, I did something stupid lifting and ended up having back surgery. And you know, my ego still is there, and you know, I can do this by myself, you know. And I lifted something I shouldn't have, and I paid for it. Still paying for it today, but anyway. But I went through that back surgery, and Joyce was able to be, she was there for me. And you know, you think you're home free and things, and you're going through life, and then 10 years later, the breast cancer was back. It was back. And I was able once again to be there with her and walk through that journey with her. And I'm here to tell you that today she is, how many years? 10 years? 12 years? 12 years free and clear of cancer that we know of today. And if that's not a miracle, that I don't know what is. But you know, God gave me the ability to go through that with her sober. He gave me the ability to be there for her and be a part of instead of apart from and a part of the problem. My son, that was a tough one. That was a tough one. But you know, I knew I had to make amends to him, and so I took him on a father-son journey. And it was about a couple of years after I'd been sober. It was a very tenuous trip. We went to Atlanta and went to ball games and did that kind of thing. And after the trip, I didn't know how well that it went. But during that trip, I made my verbal amends to him. And he had already started my journey, of course, of living amends. Some year, I guess about 4 or 5 years later, I asked my son, I said, would it interest you to do another father and son trip again? He said, Dad, I thought you'd never ask. And we went on that second trip, and we had a blast. Went back to Atlanta, and there was not a tenuous trip this time. It was really great. And I have worked very hard at building that relationship back with my son. It was about, I guess it was not long ago, just out of the blue, maybe a year ago, we were talking on the phone. He said, Dad, you're my best friend. What a gift. You can never have a gift like that. We have the best relationship today that we've ever had. But you know, we work hard at it. We both work hard at it. And he calls me on the phone, and I've got those little grandchildren call me and say, Hi, Papa T. because they love their grandfather today because of the person I am. 1992, my mother had been living with us, not with us physically, but in the same town when we started making some of those moves. And her health had gotten to be not good, and we'd had to put her in 2000. In 2000, we had to put her in a assisted living. She should have gone in a nursing home, but she'd had a mini stroke, and she'd had, you know, really had some problems. And so we did put her in an assisted living place, and they agreed to keep her, and really she got better care there than she would in a nursing home. And so she just loved my son and his wives. He loved them all, loved the grandkids. And so Thanksgiving of 2002, Tom Jr. and his then wife were coming home from North Carolina for Thanksgiving. His mother was really, really excited. And so she got, called me that night before they were supposed to, their plane was coming in, and she was all worried about what am I going to wear and on and all like that. And she talked to Joyce, and they talked about what she's going to wear, and they hung up. She called me back within 3 minutes after that, and she said, "I just want to tell you I love you." And that's the last time I ever spoke to my mother. She had a cerebral hemorrhage. They could not wake her up the next morning. She had had a fall about 2 weeks before, and we didn't know it. We knew she had the fall, but she had hit her head, and she was on Plavix, which is a blood thinner, and she'd been bleeding in her head for 2 weeks, and nobody knew it. They rushed her to the hospital that morning, and the surgeon that did my back surgery agreed to stay in town. He was supposed to catch a plane. He stayed in town and did surgery on her to see if they could remove that, all that out of her head, and he sewed her back up and said, "Tommy, it's no use." And of course, my son and his wife came in, and he was there by my side. The next Monday, the doctors determined that, you know, she wasn't going to get any better. It just, after he had had the surgery, he said it's not going to change. She had a living will, and she had very explicit instruction there that she did not want to live as a vegetable. And so the doctors called me in, and of course I was her legal representative, and what to do. And you know, there's no way in this world without all of you, without my wife, my son, my sponsor, and each and every one of the people that surrounded me, that I could have made the decision I had to make. It was the hardest decision I ever had to make in my life. And that was to pull the plug and discontinue all things. But that's what she wanted. But the members of my home group, and all, they surrounded me, and they kept me safe. Y'all all kept me safe. Bless Joyce's heart, she was more a daughter than a daughter-in-law to my mother, and I thank you for that. And my son, even though he had a job all during that 10-day period when mother died and the funeral and everything, he never left my side. His wife was there too. But can you, if you can't see God working in those things, with a guy that told his father that he didn't want him to be his father in 1988, and in 2002 he was there for me, and in 2011 told me he was his best friend, I don't know what is. Never in any of the stuff that I've been through in my life have I ever thought that a drink would make it better. And I hope I never do. It was 6 months before I really came out of the fog of my mother's death. Joyce told me afterwards, she said, "You know, I always worried that you would drink when your mother died." She had not told me that before. But that never thought to me as being a solution during all that. It never crossed my mind as being a solution. I owe all that to God and to each and every one of you. You know, just because life goes on, it doesn't mean that we don't have to deal with it. And, you know, I've been retired about a year and a half now, and I love every minute of it. I was the type of person I never thought I would retire, but I did, and Joyce retired before I did. And we have a wonderful life today. Sure, we probably, since we retired, can't do as a lot of the things we used to could do and all, but you know, we have a great life, and we have all, you know, we're so blessed. You know, I like to look today at my blessings. I don't do gratitude lists, I do blessings. Because when I'm not grateful, I can see what my blessings are, but when I'm not grateful, I can't see anything I am on a gratitude list. But I can always see the blessings I look for. And we are so blessed today to have the life that we have. Our physical health, you know, continues as we get older to not be the best, but you know, we're there for each other, and we laugh and have fun. We have fun with life today. We absolutely insist on having fun. And after 45 years, you know, she deserves a crown to live with this alcoholic. If you ever think Al-Anons have gotten the second step, I really wonder if she's ever gotten that sanity part to live with me for this many years. But I'm real grateful that she has. You know, I like to close my story with part excerpts from page 164. There was one of our trustees who died. Name was Gay, Phil Neuer. And the first time I heard her story, she explained that she closed with a page from page 164, because she says, you know, it sums up everything I've told you tonight about the message that that was given to us by the first 100. And so I think for me, I always like to close with that, because that puts a period at the end of what our message, all of our messages is today, and what the message of the first 100 is to this alcoholic. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past and give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. You know, I have been blessed. I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, as it describes in our forewords. I have not recovered from the disease of alcoholism. And I have the ability on any given day to be at peace with life on life's terms if I will follow the instructions was given to us in that last page of 164. But the key is, if I choose to. And I have that choice each morning, whether I want to follow those spiritual principles or not. Some days I do. Some days I don't do it as well. But the good news is, there's always a solution for that, and I can start that day any day over. You know, I'm so grateful for all the tools that have been given to me. I'm grateful for the messages that have been given here. I'm looking forward to hearing Ed tomorrow morning. But the thing is, I'll never be grateful enough. And I thank you for your time tonight.